Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, which you can hear around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, and on the program today, we hear about the Utahns killed in the Las Vegas mass shooting. Also, a look at the so-called bump stock technology that, for all intents and purposes, turns a semi-automatic rifle into a fully automatic gun. The story of a Utah woman who successfully sued her sexual abuser 20 years after the original deadline to sue had passed. And while gerrymandering is heard in the U.S. Supreme Court, the initiative aiming to curb the practice in Utah brings in big money. And joining me for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune reporter Luke Ramseth is with me. Good morning, Luke.
Good morning.
Also, Justice reporter Jessica Miller is here. Good morning,
Jessica. Hello.
Lee Davidson, government reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune. Welcome to you as well.
Good morning.
And Salt Lake Tribune columnist George Pyle is here as well. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
We would love to hear from you during this Friday morning news wrap-up. Post your questions and comments at sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page. You can call us at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. And much of the news cycle this week was dominated by the horrific events in Las Vegas. There were victims of the shooting from all over the country. You could say that the country itself was a victim. But there were Utahns among those killed during this attack, which left 58 dead and nearly 500 injured. And Luke Ramseth, you reported on this and helped tell the stories of a few of the many people whose lives were altered or taken away. And Luke, who were the Utah victims of this mass shooting?
Yeah, there's three that we've been kind of writing about. One is Cameron Robinson. He's 28, from St. George. Heather Alvarado, 35, Cedar City. And Nasa Tonks, who's 46, she grew up in Salt Lake City and spent a lot of time here, but actually was living in Las Vegas at the time of the attack. So,
and I understand that Nasa and Heather were both parents. They had three children each. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Heather's a mother. Yeah, mother of three, married to a firefighter, had actually gone to the festival with her 14-year-old daughter, and was just really known for being involved in her community and helping out her husband and the firefighters, really just being a good community member. And Nasa, also a mother, right? But had been living in Las Vegas for a while, but came back and would come back to Utah and ski, and so, yeah.
And I'll point out that there have been GoFundMe pages that have been launched for the families of these victims and for so many others as well. Since this was in neighboring Nevada, it stands to reason there were a number of Utahns in attendance and who witnessed this. You actually spoke with some eyewitnesses to this mass shooting, and they told harrowing tales, and a pretty striking common denominator was that no one really knew what was going on. Is that correct? I mean, people didn't know where this was coming from, what was happening.
Yeah. Yeah. First of all, I mean, it's kind of hard to say how many. We don't really know how many Utahns were there, but presumably quite a bit. It's close. And many, I don't think, you know, we talked to a few, but I don't think I also have talked to a few who don't really want to talk about it, at least not yet.
Sure.
And yeah, you're right. I mean, I think it was absolute chaos. You don't know where these shots are coming from. Even the police initially, it was really unclear where these shots are coming from. The way they described it is just pandemonium. You think maybe there's multiple shooters roaming around. Perhaps you walk around a corner and there's a shooter there. There's not a sense that this is some guy up in a 32nd story hotel room necessarily.
It was chaos.
Chaos, yeah.
There has, in the wake of the shooting, been renewed talk about trying to enact gun control measures, and we'll get to some of the specifics in just a little bit. But some past opponents of reforming gun laws say now isn't the time to talk about these things, and that this is inserting politics into a national tragedy. I want to actually ask George Pyle, because I imagine you've got something to say about that idea, that this is politicizing a tragedy. Well, and when is the right time to talk about that?
Another word for politicizing is doing something about it. That's how we deal with problems. We go through the political system. We go through our government. We say we don't like what happened. We want you to do whatever can be humanly done to it not happen again. And it's not like after 9/11, we didn't say, well, let's let some time go by before we talk about Islamic terrorism. It's absolutely absurd to say that this is not the time to talk about it. And especially when you have a mass shooting every other day, then you'll wind up with never being the time to talk about it, which is what some people want. So even though we've had some movement on this with people admitting that, you know, machine guns, fully automatic weapons, have been illegal for a long time. So even some gun rights supporters are saying, well, let's make that meaningful and do away with these devices that turn a semi-automatic weapon into an automatic weapon, because that's already illegal. So let's agree that at least we can do that.
And actually, let's turn back to Luke on that one, because we learned that the perpetrator of this act of violence had 23 firearms in this hotel room with him from where he was, you know, firing upon the crowd. A dozen of the weapons recovered had been modified in this very specific way to essentially make, as George was pointing out, machine guns out of semi-automatic rifles, or to approximate a machine gun might be the better way to say it. And that was entirely legal, that modification, right?
It is entirely legal, yeah, and it doesn't, like you said, it approximates. I mean, it sort of creates a semi-automatic weapon, and it allows it to shoot really rapidly, like a machine gun. It doesn't turn it into a fully automatic weapon, but it does allow that similar rate of fire, totally legal to purchase those since 2010.
I, you know, actually want to go back to you, George, for just one second and say, I mean, the NRA, the National Rifle Association, has signaled that at least it's not going to oppose regulating this bump stock technology, so-called bump stock technology that allows this to happen, this rate of fire. Does that seem, I mean, that's kind of remarkable, isn't it?
Well, it does. On one level, it seems like they've actually conceded that every individual in the United States doesn't have the God-given right to have whatever weapon they can find. They're actually saying that, well, maybe there is a line, maybe there is a limit. Either that, or they've just realized that this happens so often and there's so much of a call to do something that this is something, and so we will do it. Again, part of the argument of the gun rights lobby is that some things are already illegal and have been illegal for a long time. And that does or doesn't stop people from doing horrible things. I think it is kind of logical for them to have said all along, you know, you get into this argument whenever you write about guns, and then if you misuse the nomenclature in the smallest way, then the gun rights people are all over you. When you say clip, when you should have said magazine, when you say assault rifle, and that's got a kind of a squishy definition to it, when you say automatic weapon, when it wasn't, it was a semi-automatic weapon. And, you know, it's almost as bad as a newspaper editor getting upset when people don't know the difference between an editorial and an article and an ad. Like, everybody's supposed to know that. So they're saying, look, we have laws. The laws we have should be enforced. That's often the argument. And I think they're conceding in this case that fully automatic weapons are illegal, certain exceptions. This makes a weapon as close to fully automatic as you care about if you're the one being shot at. So let's go ahead and ban this, and then they can at least stand up and say, look, we caved. We compromised.
There's a bill in the Senate that will actually that aims to do this, to make this bump stock technology illegal, if I'm not mistaken. Luke, just going back to you for a second, you spoke with a gun lobbyist here in Utah, often called Utah's top gun lobbyist, a pretty well-known figure at the legislature, Clark Apashian, who showed you how this technology works. But he, and he's not alone here, isn't a fan of this device. I mean, the NRA, as we pointed out, isn't, and it turns out that most of Utah's congressional members are open to banning this. What did he have to say about it?
He told me, well, first of all, he showed me the device that, and he owns one, and it's a really simple plastic device, and it replaces the stock of the gun, and it just has some play and wiggle room, and that allows you to kind of harness the recoil of the rifle, and that creates kind of this bump, so it bumps your trigger finger a little bit to create this rapid firing. And what he said is, and I actually watched a couple folks shoot one at the range, is that it is hard to control. It's not accurate. It's less accurate than if you're shooting an actual fully automatic rifle. And so it doesn't serve a purpose if you want to go hunting, say, or even if you wouldn't buy one for self-defense either, because it's just kind of all over the place. Mm. It wouldn't be very accurate. So really, it's something that people have purchased, and it hasn't been that popular until now for going to the range and feeling like they're shooting a fully automatic weapon.
And so as a result, Clark Apashian, the gun lobbyist, essentially, I mean, he said did he signal whether he would be fine with it being banned?
Well, he didn't go that far. No, he wouldn't say that, but he did indicate that again that there's not really that he didn't have he didn't see a good use for it. He didn't even use his very often because he realized that it was kind of it just wasted a lot of ammo, basically, is what he said.
George, this bill in the Senate to ban this technology seems like, I mean, one complaint about it is that maybe it's a little narrow in scope. If you take the whole of gun violence in the United States of America, and the scale's pretty amazing, it's killed more Americans in the past 50 years than have been killed in all the wars America has ever fought. Mass shootings aren't a very significant part of that. And if you are concerned about the technology, the bump stock technology that allowed this particular mass shooter to do a very specific thing in a very specific place, that maybe that isn't solving all that much. But does that maybe provide an impetus to action on the overall or the more encompassing problem of gun violence in America, George?
Politics is the art of the possible, and they think they can get this passed. And so people who are maybe lean more to the NRA position, people who are more on the fence, can at least go to their constituents and say, well, we did something. We made it more difficult for this to happen again. But you're right. I mean, just incidents of domestic violence, people just shooting their neighbor because the music's too loud, suicides. I mean, this obviously doesn't touch that at all. And then the question becomes, is this the first step of many, or is this kind of a fence that they put up and say, look, we did this. And, as you say, the argument of people who are in favor of gun rights say we need guns for self-protection and we need guns for hunting. And when this device actually kind of runs counter to those purposes, then it becomes easier for them to say, well, we don't really want one of these anyway. I mean, it's kind of sour grapes. But so you can take that step. And of course, every time there's an event like this and many people stand up and say, we need to do something, we need to do something, we need to do a lot more than this. We need to be Australia and just ban them. And, the Australians, clearly a full parliamentary democracy, populated by convicts, no shrinking violets they. And when they said, we're killing each other in large numbers, we should quit it. And the Aussies said, yep, let's quit it. Mm. And they have.
All right. Well, again, we have to move on to some other stories here from this past week, but a tragedy in Las Vegas this past weekend. Luke, for the fundraisers for victims that you reported on, they can find those links in the articles that you wrote. Is that correct?
Yeah. Each one has a GoFundMe page that tells a little bit about them. And all three of them, I just looked at them this morning, have raised quite a bit of money already. So, yeah, you can go check those out.
Okay. All right. Well, when we come back, we're going to turn to gerrymandering, which is in the spotlight at the U.S. Supreme Court and in the state of Utah. You are listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We're going to take a break and be back in a moment.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and USU Dining Services, proudly supporting the USU Farmers Market every Thursday from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. through October 12th on the Northwest Quad.
When Ricardo Semler decided to reorganize his company, he started by asking,
why do we want everyone to be here at the same time? Why do we want to know how many hours a week people work?
So he decided he didn't need to know.
Please don't tell us all of this. We just want to make sure that you are self-directed.
Some called it anarchy. He called it radical self-organization. That story next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Join us Sunday afternoon at 2 on Utah Public Radio. programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Devour Utah, a bi-monthly magazine devoted to covering Utah's dining and drink scene with a spotlight on cooking, local happenings, and libations. Available at newsstands or online at devourutah.com.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Lee Davidson, justice reporter Jessica Miller, reporter Luke Ramseth, and Salt Lake Tribune columnist George Pyle. We are discussing this past week's local news, and we welcome your questions and comments at either sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page, or you can call us up at 801-355-8255. Lee Davidson, this week the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments in a case having to do with partisan gerrymandering. It's a case out of Wisconsin that could have a profound impact on the way in which redistricting happens or has happened in recent years. And before we get into the nuts and bolts of this, it might actually be a good idea to remind people what gerrymandering is. It's something that can happen during redistricting, and there's another term that I don't want to assume everyone is familiar with. Can you run us through those basics just to start off with, Lee?
Sure. Every 10 years after the census, states redraw their political boundaries. Often they are accused of shenanigans, and they draw boundaries in such a way that a party gets more seats than they should. That's what Wisconsin Democrats are claiming Republicans there did. They said each party gets about half the vote. Actually, Republicans get less than half the vote. But, gee, they get 60% of the legislative districts there, the way things are drawn. In Utah, Democrats have made similar claims about Republicans. Republicans have huge majorities here, but statewide they get about 65% of the vote, but they get 80% of the legislative districts. An analysis by AP last year said they probably had about three more districts than they should have if districts were drawn more fairly.
Is the drawing of those the redrawing of districts in a way that benefits a certain party, that's what we call gerrymandering. Can you say that was the intent of the people doing the redistricting at the time, was partisan gerrymandering? And how do you define that that was what was happening? And there was a sort of conspiracy to carve out and gain those seats.
Right. The numbers we were just quoting is what they offer as proof.
Okay.
And it's perfectly legal right now to gerrymander, to draw for political reasons. In fact, Jim DeBacchus, who's a state senator now, used to be the Democratic Party chairman in Utah, said in his mind there's no doubt there is political gerrymandering, and Republicans kind of acknowledge that. But he said we couldn't really sue. The only thing you could sue over is if you could show a racial or ethnic bias. And as long as gerrymandering wasn't done along those lines, there wasn't a lot they could do to fight this. That's why this case is kind of big. For the first time, if the Supreme Court goes the way Wisconsin Democrats want, drawing for political reasons only in an unfair manner would be illegal.
And so the Utahns, Senator Jim DeBacchus, as you pointed out, are cheering for the Supreme Court to ban partisan gerrymandering. If that were to happen, do we understand the mechanisms by which that ban would be enforced?
That's the problem. The Supreme Court's always said, well, how do you figure out, if it was too political? Can you come up with a test to do that? In the past, they've always had trouble figuring that out. And you can see it when it's really, really bad, but when it's just a little bit bad, it's a lot tougher to figure that out.
Again, we want to hear your thoughts on all of this. Is Utah gerrymandered? How well represented are you by your lawmakers? Call us up, 801-355-8255, or comment at sltrib.com. Lee, you mentioned that Associated Press analysis that says, yes, districts were drawn to benefit Republicans here in Utah. Do the people in charge of the legislative redistricting process say that that's what's happening, that that's what they were doing? I mean, how do they define that?
Well, it's the legislators who are in charge of it, and the governor has to sign the bill.
Okay.
And people who are challenging that or trying to change the system point out that they're choosing their own voters instead of voters choosing their representatives. They acknowledge it to a point. They say they tried to be pretty nonpartisan, but for example, there was a congressman in Utah named Jim Matheson, who's a Democrat. They carved up his district in four parts, and he realized he would have a tough time winning in any of them, especially the one he lived in. So he actually chose to run in a different district that he didn't live in, that was had more of his old district parts in it. Mm-hmm. He won, but won just barely by 700 votes against Mia Love. 2 years later, he chose not to run, and Mia Love won. Same thing had happened to him 10 years earlier. They had carved up his district, and he won, but it was a tough fight for him. Things like that, you know, they acknowledge it happened. In fact, Ralph Okerlund, who's the Senate Majority Leader, a Republican.
He co-chaired the Redistricting Commission.
Right.
Yeah.
He says, you know, we looked at Matheson. He admits that. And he said, gee, if we had given him Salt Lake City, yeah, he would have won easily. There's lots of Democrats. But if we did that, all the other districts would have been so Republican that Democrats would never have a prayer there. And so, gee, we were trying to be more fair by carving it up so that Democrats would at least have a remote chance in all of the districts.
And so I'm just wondering, it seems like you could conceivably, if you had political intentions, you could disguise those partisan intentions if you had them by pointing to, you know, balancing urban and rural districts or what you just described as, well, you know, making it more spread out.
You could. And there are different proposals out there. Like right now, there is a group called Better Boundaries.
Right.
That is trying to put on the ballot creation of an independent commissioning, redistricting commission, which in theory would be more fair, would look at trying to keep cities together, counties together in ways that made sense, rural and urban. But it would still leave the ultimate decision up to the legislature. The legislature would have to pass what they draw or reject it.
Right. And then, send it back to the table, essentially.
Yeah.
Is you actually reported that this is one of a number of proposed ballot initiatives. This initiative, the Better Boundaries, to create an independent redistricting commission, and these are ballot initiatives that are getting a lot of funding. And maybe you could tell us who the big donors are pushing to see redistricting put out of the reach of state lawmakers when it comes to designing the districts.
Well, Better Boundaries raised about $250,000. Most of the money they've spent so far has gone to collect signatures. They have to collect a lot, 113,000 statewide, to get on the ballot. Mm-hmm. Their biggest donor was Michael Weinstein, Michael Weinholz,
right.
I'm sorry, who was the Democratic nominee for governor last year. He gave $100,000. Philanthropist Barbara Tanner, related to the O.C. Tanner Company, gave $50,000. People like John and Christy Cumming. He's the CEO of Powder Corporation, which was the former owner of Powder
Mountain.
Park City Mountain Resort.
All right.
They gave $10,000 each. The initiatives are getting a lot of money. They just this past week reported it. 3 out of 5 of the main initiatives raised $800,000 so far. To put that in context, the really hot race for the special congressional district raised $90,000 less than those three combined. So. Hmm.
And these are the, as you said, the Better Boundaries Initiative. There's an initiative on medical marijuana, another on education funding,
right.
Medicaid expansion. There's also the sort of Count My Vote 2.0, for want of a better coin a phrase.
Right. And those two are just starting, Count My Vote and the other one.
Yeah, right, the Medicaid expansion one.
Medicaid expansion.
All of these are putting... They're about putting proposals directly in front of voters instead of having them go in front of lawmakers, essentially. Is that – maybe this is a question for George Pyle, actually. George, what is the cause of all of these ballot initiative proposals, a desire to sort of sidestep the legislature?
Oh, exactly. And that's why this process exists. And if you can use the word liberal in Utah, you can use it here because we have a fairly open process for people passing petitions and getting things on the ballot. They've made it a little more difficult over the years, but it's still there. It's not quite as Wild West as it is in California, but there is still a way of doing this. And the argument for doing it and the reason why there are so many, especially if they succeed, if they get enough signatures and get these on the ballot,
right.
is a feeling that the legislature is not representative of the mass of the Utah body politic. Yeah, we're a Republican state. We're a center-right state. You know, however you draw the districts, it's inconceivable that we wouldn't have a Republican legislature and a Republican governor and at least three out of the four congressional seats being held by Republicans. But there is the argument that these aren't just Republicans. These are way off to the right Republicans. If the state really – if the state governance was really reflective of the way the people felt, we wouldn't be arguing so much about public lands. We wouldn't be trying to float vouchers and other ways of undermining the public schools. We wouldn't even be talking about those things. We would be a much more small government state, but we would have been much more likely to perhaps expand Medicaid, at least under Governor Herbert's alternative that was a little more invented here. And the politics, the results coming out of the legislature, still be center-right Republican, red state, but more to the center.
Yeah, all five of these issues have come up repeatedly at the legislature and they've gone down, but polls generally show that all of these are
have popular
support.
What's the threshold that they have to meet to get onto the ballot? And I hate to ask a projecting question, but is it likely that all five of them will make it?
It's tough. It's more than 113,000 signatures, which in Utah is a lot to collect. Most of them do that by paying a lot of money to companies to go out and collect those signatures. I don't know if they'll make it or not. It's hard. People think Count My Vote will, for example. They have pledges of $1 million to help with fundraising. The others have a good shot. We'll see.
When it comes to the legislative redistricting ballot initiative, I can't help but offer a little bit of a plug here for KCPW. There's a program in the Hive that covered redistricting in depth. You can check it out at our website, sltrib.com. It will be interesting to see what makes it onto the ballot and what passes. Really fascinating stuff. Thanks to Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Lee Davidson, who will be keeping an eye on it. I think let's head actually to another quick break, and then when we come back, we will turn to the story of a Utah woman who sued her sexual abuser 20 years after the deadline to file a lawsuit. You are listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the Mountain Arts and Music Festival Saturday, October 7th, offering live music from 10 a.m. to dusk at Huntsville Square, evening music by Chris O'Rock and the Laszlos. Details at mountainartsandmusic.com.
On the next Radio Lab,
I assumed that there had to be some sort of check and balance so that one man couldn't just order the launch of nuclear weapons.
The fate of humanity should not rest on one person.
He could launch the kind of a devastating attack the world's never seen. He doesn't have to check with anybody. He doesn't have to call the Congress. He doesn't have to check with the courts. He has that authority because of the nature of the world we live in.
That's on the next Radio Lab.
Join us Tuesday morning at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the Cache Valley Visitors Bureau presenting the Cache Valley Foodie Trek, access to the National Forest, and live theater opportunities. More information available online at explorelogan.com.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Jessica Miller, Lee Davidson, Luke Ramseth, and George Pyle. You can join us by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. And to Salt Lake Tribune Justice reporter Jessica Miller. Now, Jessica, you wrote about someone who had been a childhood victim of sexual abuse, but who only now is getting some restitution, if not justice. Mm. And it's because of a recent law change here in Utah, which we'll talk about. But this is the story of Ginger Utley, and maybe you can just tell us her story and this difficult chapter of her life that starts back in 1989.
Yeah, in 1989, her sexual abuse started. Her Sunday school teacher began sexually abusing her, and that lasted. She was 13 at that time, and it lasted about 5 years until she was 18 years old. And she, told a lot of people about this abuse. She told the man's wife. She told her mom. She told a couple of bishops in the LDS church that she was a part of. She told her cheerleading coach. And for years, no one really did anything about this. And then when she was 18 years old, she came home with some bruising that her mom saw, and she called the police. And from there, the man was charged with a couple counts of sexual abuse of a child, but he took a plea deal and pled guilty to some lewdness charges and was sentenced to some home confinement. And that was about when she was 18. And according to the law at that time, if she wanted to bring a civil lawsuit against him, she had until she was 22 years old, which I'm not sure she was even aware that that was a possibility at that time, nor was she prepared at 22 to bring a civil lawsuit against him.
And that was 4 years after the abuse had stopped, just
yes.
4 years after the abuse had stopped. A tragic part of her story from the time period when she's telling people what's happening is that she didn't get a lot of help from the authority figures in her life who she was confiding what was happening to her to. And specifically, I'm thinking of a Mormon bishop who Utley says told her that she needed to repent. Is that correct?
Yeah. So she told her cheerleading coach, and her coach told her own bishop. And that bishop told her to repent. And then she told her own bishop, and that bishop told her, you know, we're not going to let him be your Sunday school teacher anymore. And I think he said that he would tell people that, you know, that this man had an affair with a woman, not a child. Hmm.
And then her abuser actually, if I read your article correctly, told her what she could and could not say during the trial, essentially was coaching her on how to behave during the
trial.
Yeah,
that's what she said. And there wasn't really a trial. He was charged, and then they offered him this plea deal, and she said she didn't really have much of a say. And I looked at the transcript from the sentence, and it looked like her mother kind of spoke on her behalf, and it seemed like no one really wanted jail time for him. He had letters from, you know, his bishop and stake president, people like that, saying that he was, you know, a really good guy, and that he, you know, he's getting therapy and that he's changed and that jail would harm him. And so the judge didn't order that.
Okay, so flash forward to the past couple of years. Mm-hmm. A law change, actually this is a law change from last year, I believe.
Well, it started in 2015. In that year, lawmakers eliminated the deadline for these sorts of cases, but it didn't apply to older cases like Ginger. So she was already over 22, so it didn't apply for her. And so last year, lawmakers kind of opened this window. It's either a three-year window or 35 years past your 18th birthday, whichever one's longer.
Hmm. And so that allowed her for what to actually go ahead and sue her abuser.
Yes, yeah, she sued him. The law actually went into effect on her birthday, and so she sued a month later. She was 42 at that time, and because of the admissions back in the 90s when he had admitted to these lewdness charges, she kind of had that proof that this abuse had happened, and so she was able to settle her case really quickly. Just a couple months, which is really fast for a civil lawsuit. So they came to a settlement and a financial settlement, and then he also was banned from interacting with youth for the next 10 years.
How did that law change come about? I mean, was there somebody who was kind of a champion trying to make this happen in the legislature?
Yes. Representative Ken Ivory kind of was pushing for this. I think his wife was a victim of abuse similar to this, and so he kind of was championing that over the 2015 and 2016.
And one of the reasons that Utley came forward with this story is to let other people know, others who, you know, who are out there who might know or who might not know that this is an option for them, you know, suing their abusers, especially people who fall into, a certain time window.
Yeah, for those that are past that, you know, 35 plus 15 or 18, whatever that is, there's that three-year window, and that's already halfway over. So there's about 18 months left. So she just, you know, wanted to bring awareness that this change has happened. And if there's people who are in that three-year window, to let them know they still have time, but not very much time.
Like a year and a half left.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to actually turn to another story now that relates to sexual assault. It's actually sexual assault on college campuses, and it's one that you covered as well. Related to Westminster College. This is, Westminster was one of a number, is, I guess, until recently, one of a number of colleges that have faced federal scrutiny as a result of how they handle sexual assault. But they've essentially, they came out and announced that they are no longer under investigation. Is that accurate?
Yes. So they have been under investigation for about 3 years now. I think they were one of the first schools to come under a Title IX investigation. And they announced this week that they've been cleared of this. They're that the Department of Education found that there wasn't any Title IX violations in this one complaint. There was a 2013 incident that was being considered. And so while they weren't at fault in that, they did have some lapses in their policies. So they did change some policies along the way. But in that specific instance, they weren't at fault.
Okay. How many Utah universities are actually under investigation? Do you know? I mean, it's a tough question for you to...
A lot of them. Yeah. There's four, I think, right now that are under a Department of Education investigation, and then Utah State University is under an investigation by the Department of Justice, which that's a little bit different. There's a lot of them that are still pending.
Mm-hmm. George Pyle, I don't know how to bring you into this conversation other than to, it's an ongoing, we talked about gun violence earlier, a sort of problem that's not going away. Here's another problem that doesn't seem to be going away. Both from the sexual abuse standpoint of people, but also sexual assault on college campuses. Yeah.
Well, there are some experts in this field who will look at the statistics and see more and more reporting of sexual abuse of children, sexual violence on campus, see that the incidence of it seems to be going up, and they'll actually read that as good, because what that means is people are reporting it. You can, when people don't report it, of course, you don't know. They do surveys anonymously so that people, when they say, yes, I've been abused, that isn't made public anywhere. It's just an aggregate survey, and you get some really horrific numbers sometimes, which sometimes are so horrific that it allows people to deny it's even happening because it can't possibly be that many. Well, even if it's a third of that many, it's still a lot. So we are coming to the point now, I think, where universities are realizing that this is on them, that Title IX requires, we think of Title IX as being the athletic thing that requires women to have a shot at athletics and athletic scholarships. It's much larger than that. It requires universities to create an atmosphere where women and men can have an equal access to college education and everything that goes with that, including athletics. And it's on the university to make the atmosphere safe and to investigate individual charges of sexual assault, and also, as was the case with Westminster, to have policies that make it clear that if you think you've been a victim of that, then you have a place to go. You have a place, at least somebody who will listen to you and help you deal with it, and outside the criminal justice system. And then in the case now where the Justice Department is looking into it, then you also have a question of whether the entire justice system has fallen apart, and whether, in addition to a campus university president maybe wanting to just look the other way, then you start to wonder if the campus police, the local police, the sheriff, the prosecutor are also looking the other way, kind of throwing this boys will be boys at you and pretending like it doesn't matter.
Reminder to listeners that you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Jessica Miller, in the time that you've been covering sexual assault on college campuses, I should point out that you're part of the Tribune team that won a Pulitzer for that kind of reporting. Has the conversation changed at all? Has there been... I don't want to make you say whether or not progress has happened, but has the way that the story is being told changed at all?
I think that there's been more conversation, which is good. I've been speaking a lot in different college classes, and when I was in school 10 years ago, I thought Title IX was about sports. I had no idea, and now when I go to these classes and I ask these kids, like, do you know what Title IX is? Like, oh my gosh, yes, we know. Like, there's a lot more education happening. First year students are having to take classes or, a little course talking about Title IX and consent and things like that. So I think the conversation's definitely been changing in the last year or so.
Hmm. All right. Guys, we have just about 5 minutes before we have to turn to our underplayed stories of the week. And I want to turn to one more story from this past week's news that Lee Davidson covered. And Lee, I'm just, without further introduction, I'll just say this has to do with electric vehicles and a sort of grid of electric vehicle or a plan for electric vehicles in Western states. What is this? Tell us about this.
Well, governors in 7 Western states have agreed to work together to make it easier to drive electric vehicles down the freeway. They only have a range of about 200 miles, and if you're out in the middle of nowhere and there's no recharging station, that makes it hard. So they're working together to make sure that there's a nice network along all the major freeways. There's 5,000 miles of freeways in those seven states, and they want to make sure they're electrified.
And so several, I mean, the governors of a variety of Western states are saying, we're what, creating charging stations? Just places where you can go and plug your electric vehicles in?
Right. There's more to it also. They want to make sure that all of the charging stations are compatible with each other, come up with some standards, et cetera. Utah already started its own effort a few months ago, working with Maverick stations. I-15 will be the first one that will make sure they have charging stations. So Utah wanted to make sure that people could get to all of its big five national parks easily. And they're starting with the ones not too far off of I-15, like Zion National Park.
How many cars, electric vehicles, are there out there on the roads in this region?
I don't know. But okay. Someone asked them that, and they said a lot.
Yeah.
but there's being more. And when things like this happen, they figure that will be even more. Interestingly, there are car manufacturers who have vowed to stop making gasoline-powered vehicles and go to all electric, in the next 15, 20 years. Legislature's actually worried that they're losing too much gas tax money. And they're looking at how to tax alternate fuel vehicles, including electric vehicles. In fact, they talked this week about raising their registration rates so they can tax you that way. And give people an option, they can either pay that higher registration rate for their electric vehicle, or they can attach a gizmo that would measure how many miles they drive, and they could pay per mile. Oregon does that sort of thing on a trial basis now.
Okay, and a lot of that is just for infrastructure, maintaining roads,
right.
Having a source of revenue to do that. George Pyle, electric vehicles, the growth of electric vehicles, any comments?
Well, it does seem like the manufacturers have decided that this is the wave of the future. They're talking about they're going to shift more and more to this after years and years of saying, oh, no, we couldn't possibly do that. No, electric cars, that's science fiction. That isn't going to work. And it does kind of build on itself. It becomes a critical mass. You have more electric cars, so they put in more charging stations. And then people see there are charging stations, so they buy electric cars. Because the big fear of an electric car is that you'll run out of charge in the middle of nowhere someplace, and you'll be absolutely stuck. Even they say, even at the Tesla dealership, sometimes they'll say, now look, you've got a limited range here, and you need to be aware of that. You extend that range, you make it more attractive for people to buy those cars, and the internal combustion engine may be on its way out.
Well, when manufacturers are, as Lee pointed out, committing to making changing to electric vehicles in some instances, or making a certain number per year, that makes a difference as well. I actually want to turn to one final story before we go to our underplayed stories of the week. And Lee, this is another one that you covered, which is there's a legislative task force that is proposing a state takeover of the Utah Transit Authority, of our transit agency here in Utah, as opposed to having the governing body that runs it now, it would be the state of Utah that runs it now. Why are they proposing that?
UTA's faced a lot of scandals in recent years. Been a lot of controversy over high pay or sweetheart deals with developers. They were under federal investigation. They cut a deal this year to get amnesty. To cooperate in cases against former and current members. And there's been questions about whether they're spending their money wisely, et cetera. And the legislature ordered this task force to look at, among other things, how UTA should be governed. The options they're looking at now would have much more state involvement. A complete state takeover and making UTA part of the Utah Department of Transportation has kind of been rejected. But there are some other things they're looking at, essentially even perhaps taking over by the state all UTA facilities. There's some problems with that. UTA's way in debt. And so
$2 billion, right?
Right. Yeah. And that was mostly to build new rail systems that they have. And the state worries that could ruin its credit rating. And so they've looked at some other ways to let UTA keep ownership of its current facilities, but the state would build new ones with state money and have ownership of the new ones. And they're still kicking it around, but it looks like UTA is on the path to having much more state oversight.
Okay, one way or another. So that, but that debt. Just a quick question on the debt, Lee. How would that affect Utah's, you know, sort of financial position, its credit rating, and so on and so forth? That's a concern to lawmakers.
Right. Utah has kind of a perfect credit rating. UTA not so much. It's not bad, but it's a lot of debt. And worse, UTA is looking at borrowing more in coming years to handle maintenance of tracks and trains. They can't handle it just on the money that they're getting through sales tax and fares. And so there's even more debt coming, and the state doesn't really want to take that on because they'd have to raise sales state sales tax to pay for it, that sort of thing.
George Pyle, you've been providing commentary this whole time. Is there, you know, now we're talking about electric vehicles before this, now UTA, are we gonna see a merging of those two things happen at some point? Self-driving electric vehicles is
the thing. We had the trolley square and you see the pictures. We had this trolley system that was all over town and it was ahead of its time and it was a wonderful thing. Everybody bought a car. So we tore up all the tracks and everybody had a car. Then we thought, you know, we need trolleys, so we put in tracks. And we spent $1 billion on building the tracks, and all the mayors wanted, and the airport wants it. And now we're going to have self-driving electric cars, so we're probably going to tear up the tracks again, and everybody's going to have a self-driving electric car, because apparently they're not going to give us flying cars the way they promised they would in the 21st century.
Let's dial it back from the futuristic talk here to the Utah Transit Authority may be becoming part of the state in some portion, according to Lee Davidson, his reporting.
The problem is they need more money, and even they know they can't get more money until they have more public trust. Part of building public trust is providing better service. They can't provide better service until they have more money. So we're in this spiral, and they're looking at this as a way to get out of that spiral. I don't know that turning over UTA to a state where the state government itself has a reputation for sweetheart deals and sucking up to developers would necessarily be that much of an improvement, but it would be different.
Lee, any other fixes for UTA's budget? I mean, any beyond providing additional money from the state legislature?
Well, they're looking at maybe changing highway and transportation funding so that it would be one big pot for highways and transit, so that both would compete with each other for what's truly needed for goals of the state. It would be decided by the Utah Transportation Commission, which exists now to put priorities on highway funding. UTA does its own thing, but they're thinking of maybe throwing them together. But I would note, UTA ran into problems again last week. They thought they were fixing, finally, complaints about their high salaries, and so they cut benefits for administrators a bit, but not enough. One maverick member of the board said, look, this is still far too generous. It's more generous than we're giving everyone else. And it created a hullabaloo. And this week up at the legislature, it was brought up a lot. And telling UTA officials, you know, why did you do this again? And
it's... Well, a continual spotlight on Utah Transit Authority. We'll keep watching it, of course, and see what happens with whether or not it becomes part of the state. Guys, it's time to turn to our underplayed stories of the week, the final segment of the show. And Lee Davidson, I will give you the first option here.
Oh, I'll go with a story about a study by the University of Utah about all the electronics that are crammed into modern cars. David Strayer, psychology professor up there, for years has looked at distractions caused by cell phone talking or texting, and became famous for saying that's more dangerous than even drunken driving. He's saying all these gizmos are worse than that. They're very distractive. You know, they now allow drivers to Facebook, to text, to watch videos, to program navigation tools while they're driving. They were finding that drivers take their eyes off the road as long as 24 seconds. They said this stuff is just very dangerous, and car manufacturers are doing whatever they can without thinking whether they should do it or not.
Well, that's the interesting part, is that it's getting into cars before there's a chance to say, hey, hang on, this is dangerous.
Right. And people figure because it's in the car, it must be fine, right?
Yeah. All right. I'm going to turn to Luke Ramseth for your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week. What do you got?
Yeah. My colleague Emma Penrod wrote a story about water. October 1st is the end of the water year, the start of a new water year. And this past year has been some some good news. Precipitation levels normal or above normal, which I think kind of takes us out of this five-year drought that we've been in, and reservoirs are three-quarters full, which kind of puts us in a good position for next year. So water-wise, some good news, I think, which has been rare these past few years.
Yeah, it seemed like, drought being the new normal and this being the sort of rarity. But good water news from Emma Penrod's reporting and Luke Ramseth's pick for Underplayed story. Jessica Miller, your pick for Underplayed.
So I'm going to pick a story I wrote earlier this week about how police officers in Salt Lake County, starting Monday, will have to fill out a questionnaire about whether they've been caught lying on the job or have biases. It's a new policy from the Salt Lake DA's office. And depending on the case, prosecutors might turn that information over to the defense so that it can be used in cross-examination or to challenge an officer's credibility. So that'll be interesting.
It's essentially self-reporting about whether or not you lie on the job, as if you're a police officer. Is that correct, this survey?
Yeah. It's if there's a sustained finding in your police department. So if your boss has determined that you lied, then they have to turn that over.
Okay, which would be used in court cases. That's
interesting.
All right. George Pyle, your pick for Underplayed story.
Well, just breaking this morning, you may remember ex-Representative William Jefferson of Louisiana, especially if you get your news from late night talk shows. He was busted for bribery. They found $90,000 in cash in his freezer. The court has ordered him released from prison today for basically the same reason that Utah Attorney General's Shurliff and Swallow got off, because of a Supreme Court ruling that you have to have a really clear quid pro quo. I gave this public official money and he did something for me that he otherwise would not have done. Former governor of Virginia got out of prison on that theory. Cases here in Utah have fallen apart on that theory. And now the guy with $90,000 in his freezer has been released because prosecutors weren't able to point to an illegal act that the legislator did in return for all that money.
Wow. Really interesting story there.
It is.
George Pyle, thanks for your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week. For my part, I'm going to go with, the deal between the University of Utah and the Huntsman Cancer Institute, a new memorandum of understanding. The U is going to pay $68 million to the institute. The Huntsman Cancer Foundation is recommitting to providing $120 million in new donations by 2025. And I think we all remember the kind of fallout between the fight between the U and the Huntsman Cancer Institute. Interesting to see them maybe potentially burying the hatchet. We'll see how it goes. Thanks very much to Luke Ramseth, Jessica Miller, Lee Davidson, and George Pyle, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Again, guys, thanks for being here.
Thanks.
Thank you.
That does it for this edition of the show. Thanks very much to KCPW's Jesse Ellis. And up at Utah Public Radio, we've got Tom Williams, Spencer Holsey, Alyssa Roberts, and Christy Aachen, who manage the broadcast. Thanks also to the show's producer, Emily Means. You can find podcasts of this program and a great deal more at our website, kcpw.org. Find us on Facebook. We are KCPW-FM. On Twitter, we are at KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. You've been listening to Behind the Headlines. Thanks for tuning in. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Philip K. Dick wrote some of the craziest science fiction ever, and it's weirdly, creepily relevant today. But what was he like as a person? We asked his ex-wife.
I think that someone like Philip comes along every 1,000 years or so. He is so unique.
The life and work of Philip K. Dick. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRX.
Join us Sunday morning at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
I'm John Kovash, Utah Public Radio correspondent for Moab in Southeast Utah. If you have comments, questions, or ideas for stories for any of us at the station, please visit our website at upr.org or call 1-800-826-1495. You can also share your ideas with us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Be sure to include the hashtag IMUPR. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, also heard at upr.org.